Please welcome Mr. Max Musson.
Thank you very much, Julie. We're just having a bit of a discussion there about what you say to people that are new to the ideas of nationalism. Just occurred to me that an approach that I've used in the past to quite good effect is just to talk to people about Red Indians, because most families I've found have got a kind of a legend that somewhere there's a great uncle or a great great grandfather or something like that who's got a dab of of Red Indian blood in them. I don't know how all these families in England and very rural parts of England and even parts of Scotland and Wales would have come to have had a little dab of Red Indian blood in them, but there's lots of families that have this kind of a legend behind them. And when you talk to people, if you just talk to them a bit about Red Indians, people have got this romantic idea of the noble savage riding round on horseback with his feathered headdress on and all this kind of stuff. And it's a very romantic ideal. And if you then talk to them about what happened to the Red Indians and about how their land was invaded by Europeans and that they were pushed back and pushed back into an ever-decreasing amount of space where they were attacked, and in some cases there were kind of genocidal attacks on Indian villages where the entire village was wiped out, things like that happened. And the reason why the Red Indians lost is because there were so few, they were disunited, because the Europeans that came initially were very, very few in number. They were technically superior in view of the fact they had firearms, etc. But lots of corrupt Europeans, when they arrived in the Americas, would sell guns to the Indians. And there's lots of Western films that are all made about, you know, the theme of somebody selling guns to the Indians. But it was the fact that the Indians were disunited, whereas the Europeans coming in were united and then just gradually steamrolled over them and pushed them back. And you talk to people about that and they go, oh yeah, what a shame it was that these noble savages were almost completely genocided out of existence. And almost everybody will sympathise with that. And then you say to them, what do you think that the Indians should have done? And after you've described about the fact that their vital weakness was the fact that they were disunited, they said, well, they ought to have united, of course, and they ought to have worked together as a cohesive whole against the Europeans that were invading them. And then you can just really draw a parallel between what happened in North America and what's happening here in Europe today. Just say, what do you think Europeans ought to do now in view of the fact that the same thing is happening to us that happened to the Red Indians in North America? Anyway, that's not the title of or the subject matter that I intended to speak about today. What I intend to speak about today is, a working title I've got for what I'm going to talk to you about is Nationalism, Which Way Now? It's been a feature of a number of articles that I've written over the 4 years or so that the Western Spring website has been in existence. And in February 2015, I wrote an article which was entitled Nationalism, Which Way Now?, in which I wrote, since the days of the British Brothers League in the late 1800s, British nationalism seems to have now reached its lowest ebb following the collapse of the British National Party at a time when there is no clear successor organisation to follow and seemingly no clear ideological path forward either. And I went on. Both organisationally and ideologically, many nationalists therefore find themselves standing at a crossroads. And that was in 2015. We're now in 2018, so almost exactly 3 years later. And I would put it to you that nationalism is now at an even lower ebb than it was in 2015, especially following the proscription of national action and the subsequent criminalisation of extremism. It's organisationally and ideologically, many nationalists are still standing at the crossroads, and it's exactly the same crossroads they were standing at in 2015. To the left, not ideologically to the left, but just to the left in that direction, we have the electoral route to power that a lot of people like to pursue and are obsessed with. And to the right, we've got the confrontational street demonstrations that other types of nationalist organisations are very enamoured with. And these two traditional routes have sadly always led to failure. Electioneering has blamed and attributed its past failure to bias by the media or in the media. It's been blamed on a lack of funding, the fact that nationalist organisations just don't have the funds in order to have the quality of candidates and the quality of campaigns necessary to compete with the established political parties. And it's very often blamed on infiltration and sabotage. And you've only got to go back, I don't know whether there are still any actually on the internet now, but Joe Owens was always sticking podcasts on the internet telling everybody about the infiltration sabotage by all the usual suspects, and it's become kind of legendary as a result of his constant input in that direction. These factors were at play in the collapse of the British National Party, and we've all witnessed them at play in the collapse of UKIP. We had the picture there, the incongruous picture of the little whippet next to the Great Dane, and everybody was, and it's, you know, it must have crossed everybody's mind that there's more to that picture than meets the eye. And certainly I think that the catalogue of catastrophe that's befell UKIP over the last couple of years, with the multiple changes of leadership and all of the bizarre happenings, from like a punch up in a car park and all this kind of thing, you have to accept that that is more than just coincidence. It's more than just what happens, that there had to be some kind of sabotage behind all of that that was taking place. Confrontational street demonstrations attribute their past failure to violence directed at them by Antifa, and they also attribute it to a bias in the media, to heavy-handed and biased policing. And of course what we've seen is that particularly in the like the final days of the EDL and other organisations, the police, when they had a demonstration, would kettle them, would lead them off down to some little back alley to a car park that's at the rear of some disused industrial buildings, and would let them make their speeches and things there, where nobody could see them and nobody could hear them, and then they would all be shuffled off and dispersed and sent home. And so the demonstration would have been a complete and utter waste of time in the vast majority of cases. Even in the few instances where those demonstrations marched along a public thoroughfare through a town, what you'd have had is you'd have had members of the public walking along, and there would have been a rank of left-wing extremists all screaming blue murder. Then there would have been a rank of very surly, very burly-looking, very serious-faced police officers making it very apparent that they didn't really want to be there, and they thought this was a thundering nuisance, the fact they had to walk along the street. And then on the other side of the police officers would have been the nationalist demonstrators who would have been marching along. And so the public would have had virtually no opportunity to converse with those demonstrators, and they would have not been able to hear what those demonstrators were saying because of the left-wing extremists screaming in front of them, and they would have just thought that this was a parade by a motley bunch of the most hated members of society, and they would have gone home and thought nothing more about it. We've also had the public order and anti-terror legislation that's been introduced over the years that I've listed on previous occasions, and I don't intend to list it again now, but it has enabled and made it easy really for the authorities to criminalise nationalist activists to get involved in confrontational events in public. And these factors were at play as far back as Mosley's British Union of Fascists, that they were quite obviously at play during the White Man Marches of more recent years, during the Dover anti-immigration demonstrations, and during the progressive criminalisation of national action, paving the way for that organisation's eventual proscription. And What we've seen here in both the electoral tactics and also the demonstration tactics is a kind of David versus Goliath process, where a tiny little organisation has been taking on the might of the state, and of course the might of the state is always going to prevail in those situations. And what we've seen is, over the last couple of years or so, a major offensive by the government to criminalise and to disrupt and limit the nationalist movement. This began pretty much with David Cameron and Theresa May announcing that they were going to introduce disruption measures and control orders to target those who they regard as extremists but who act within the law. And this was all, you know, pretty much accepted by the public as being quite a sensible thing. And if the people that are being disrupted and the people that are having these control orders imposed upon them are people who are actively advocating violence and who are actively participating in violence, then that would appear to be a very measured kind of response. But when we consider that the vast majority of people have had these kind of control orders and disruption tactics employed against them have been people who have been perfectly law-abiding, it shows really that those measures are police state measures aimed at suppressing people who say things that the government doesn't like. As a result of the progressive introduction of these kind of things, we've seen political activists, as has already been mentioned earlier on this afternoon, political activists barred from entering Britain. And these are political activists that have no criminal record, that have never been involved in violence. They are just barred from entering England because they're going to either say things that the government doesn't like, or because they're going to interview people who are going to say things that the government doesn't like. And so again, it is just pure suppression. It is pure, the pure suppression of free speech and the rights of the people in this country to engage in political discussion, etc. We've also seen, as has already been mentioned as well, the pressure on social media companies. And so the government have met with Google and with Facebook, etc., and they've been very heavy-handed in telling them that there will be legislation introduced to curb what those companies can do and to penalise those companies if those companies don't start policing the platforms that they have on the internet. And so we've seen numerous people having their Facebook profiles erased, being suspended from Facebook, having their YouTube channels shut down in the way that my YouTube channel was shut down recently. And these things have been done by and large without any due process. People haven't been warned in the majority of cases. What happens is that one day they go to log into their YouTube channel and they find that they can't do it, and a little window opens up and says, you have transgressed, you've breached rather this company's social program or whatever the phraseology is, I can't think of it at the moment, and your channel has been shut down. If you would like to appeal against this, then please press this button here. And so you click on that button and a little screen opens up where it invites you to give your name and your contact details, and it invites you to explain why it is you haven't breached their code of conduct. And in view of the fact they've not told you in what way you've breached their code of conduct, it's very difficult for you then to explain that you didn't actually breach their code of conduct. And so but as best you can, you fill it in explaining why you haven't done any of the things you could imagine you must have done in order to breach their code of conduct. And then you press send, and another little window opens up and says that because of a technical problem, it's unable to send your message at this time. And so, of course, you just don't have any kind of redress whatsoever with these people. So there's this plethora of police state legislation that now exists, and it's used very sparingly where immigrant groups are concerned, and that's largely because those immigrant groups have got influence in high places. But it's always applied very heavy-handedly against nationalists. And this is in the face of the fact that the vast bulk of terrorist crimes that have been committed in this country and throughout Europe, really, have been perpetrated by Islamic extremists. But the government doesn't seek to ban their ideology. The government always insists there are good Muslims, and it's only a small minority that perpetrate acts of terrorism. The government interacts with Muslim groups and describes them as fine, upstanding members of society. And it's only the extremists that are the ones that are involved in any terrorism at all. But they have a very entirely different approach with regard to nationalists. There's no concept of the good, fine, upstanding nationalist. Every nationalist and nationalism is always regarded as anathema and something for which there is no place in decent society. This is the way the government always talk. And it's no matter, it doesn't matter how many atrocities are committed in the name of Islam. Islam is always referred to as a religion of peace, and yet it only took one lunatic called Thomas Mayer, and suddenly nationalist ideology has no place in a civilised society. And that's the double standard that exists here. We've had recent high-profile prosecutions. Alison Chablow and Jez Turner have been mentioned earlier on this afternoon. And these prosecutions are all predicated on the assertion of anti-Semitism. It seems that Jewish organisations deem it grossly offensive for nationalists to refer to Jewish transgressions, or Jewish competition, in fact, against the interests, because between any two ethnic groups, there very often will be competition for their ethnic interests, quite legitimately. But any mention of Jewish transgressions against the interests of non-Jews is regarded as grossly offensive and anti-Semitism. But when Jews constantly harp on about transgressions, the transgressions of non-Jews against them, that strangely doesn't constitute anti-Gentilism. It's regarded as legitimate historical commentary. So as far as discussion of the Holocaust is concerned, if a revisionist historian says it didn't happen, or a particular aspect of the Holocaust narrative didn't happen in the way that is generally accepted, and produces some documentary evidence to establish that as a fact, it doesn't matter that he's produced documentary evidence to establish that as a fact. It's still anti-Semitism, because as with all of these kind of these anti-free speech, race-related laws, the truth has no bearing on it whatsoever. The truth is never a defence, and the truth can't be a defence against claims of anti-Semitism. We've had a situation recently where Jews have implied that globalism, the term globalism is a euphemism for Jews, and that when people say that they're anti-globalist, that really what they're saying is that they're anti-Jews. And there's been this famous mural that Jeremy Corbyn has commented on, or perhaps didn't comment on in quite the right way, which showed a group of apparently middle-aged white men with grey hair and spectacles and a moustache sitting around a Monopoly table, and the Monopoly table was resting on the backs of people who are supposed to be the bulk of humanity, and the slogan behind them was that globalism is the enemy of humanity or something of that sort. And Jewish organisations have just decided that these grey-haired, middle-aged men with spectacles and moustaches just happen to be Jews, and that this is an anti-Semitic kind of trope. When in fact there's no reason to believe that at all, unless of course you've fallen into the trap of thinking that globalism is a euphemism for Jews, because the people sitting around the table look no more Jewish than I do, and I don't think I look particularly Jewish. What you have is a situation where the artist, who's called Mayer One, I believe, when he was quite queried and questioned about this, he just said, well, around the table are people representing the Rothschilds and the Warburgs and some capitalist white dudes, or words to that effect. And so, strange that the fact that some of these, one or more of these middle-aged white men with grey hair and moustaches and spectacles sitting around the table are regarded as being Jewish bankers, that it's anti-Semitic. But the fact that the artist intended that some or more of them, or some of them should actually not be Jews, isn't regarded as being anti-whiteism or anti-Gentilism. And there's no uproar from European politicians, from British politicians in the main political parties against this association of the evils of globalism with being white. And that's strange, really. People can say, oh yes, but a lot of the people who are pushing the globalist agenda are white, and that's perfectly true. But if it is anti-Semitism to state the fact that a number of the people that are pushing globalism are Jews, it must, by the same logic, be anti-Gentilism and anti-white to say that a number of the people pushing globalism are white European people. But people don't make that connection. It seems that the facts are irrelevant if anti-Semitism is the outcome. It's interesting that this use of this assertion that any mention of a specific ethnicity being involved in something which might be regarded as disreputable being an example of hate speech has been taken up by the Polish government. And the Polish government recently passed a law which is very controversial, and Jewish organisations protested mightily the fact that this law was passed, where the Poles have passed a law saying that anybody who makes a public statement linking Polish people during the Second World War era to atrocities against the Jews is guilty of hate speech. And even though there probably were some Polish people who did commit atrocities against the Jews, the Polish government have used that same principle of the truth having no bearing on it, and this is just all a matter of preventing any event or any factor being discussed in society which reflects badly upon your favoured ethnic group. And so what we have is a situation there where the Polish government have kind of turned the logic used by Jewish organisations in this country back on themselves. They've kind of exposed and exploited this double standard. So, there is this double standard. The problem is that the double standard that's applied, and you know, that's an example of one double standard, but there are lots of double standards that are applied in the racial politics of this country. But those double standards, they can't be exposed and they can't really be countered through electoral campaigning. And the reason for that is that with electoral campaigning, the media, the mass media, are needed to convey our message to the public, and the mass media don't want to convey our message to the public. Our message is always degraded or it's censored out before it reaches the public, and so that doesn't work. And we've already mentioned the confrontational street demonstrations, where the way in which those street demonstrations are organised is done deliberately to prevent our message from reaching the public. And so therefore, this kind of double standard can't actually be countered through street demonstrations. And we're missing out in one vital respect. And there was a very interesting article that was pointed out to me recently, which is on the Jewish Chronicle website, written by Stephen Pollard, who's the editor of the Jewish Chronicle. And what he wrote, and I've transposed a little bit the statements here so that it makes completely clear sense, because the way it was actually written in the article didn't actually make it quite as obvious as I like to make it. And he said, "Yesterday's Enough is Enough rally was the most extraordinary event of my almost 10 years as editor of the JC. When on Sunday the Board of Deputies and the JLC proposed a rally at Parliament Square and issued a strongly worded open letter to Jeremy Corbyn, there was an intake of breath in some quarters. Not the way we do things. Not enough people will turn up. It will backfire. No one will care." And then he goes on, "We are not by nature an angry community, nor do we take to the streets. When we have a worry, more often than not, we talk to ourselves about it and then perhaps try and talk behind the scenes to the powers that be." And organised minority groups don't try to win elections based on their own numbers, because they can't, because they are a minority. They have to use the numbers that the mass media provide them. What do they usually take to the streets and protest? Because again, being a minority group, they just don't have the numbers. They bypass all that and they go straight to the organ grinder instead of performing in front of the organ grinder's monkey. And what they tend to use is their disproportionate influence, which is very often based in their disproportionate wealth, to bend the ear of those in high political office. And our thinking as nationalists is currently out of date in this respect. We think of ourselves as the majority. And because we think of ourselves as a majority, we think we ought to be able to win elections. But because of the factors I've already discussed, we can't win elections. And we think to ourselves, because we're the majority, we ought to be able to go storming out into the streets and have massive demonstrations. But we can't go storming out into the streets for the reasons we've already discussed there. What we have to wake up to the fact is that we, and I'm really deferring to the people, Mummy Spider, in this room, the people in this room are what I would describe as the awakened whites. We, the awakened whites, are a minority in this country. White people generally are the majority, but we, the awakened whites, we're a minority. And if we're going to prosper, if we're going to have political influence and eventually garner political power in this country, we've got to recognise the fact that we're a minority, and we've got to copy the tactics employed by organised minority groups. At this stage, we don't need to have the freedom to wage high-profile campaigns, we don't need electoral campaigns, and we don't need high-profile protests, because we don't have the numbers and we don't have the wherewithal in order to carry them off properly. We shouldn't really try this. We have no mass media capable of conveying the message to the masses, and what we've got to do is to try and bend the ear of people in political power. And as we stand at the crossroads, we've looked at what's left and what's right, but what is ahead of us is the route towards organised minority status. And that's the route that I think we should take, because if we can advance and be successful as an organised minority, other people of our ethnicity will see what we're doing, they will see that we're achieving success, and success attracts like-minded people, success breeds success, and we will ultimately become the organised majority. There's an old National Socialist slogan, which is that National Socialism is the organised will of the people. And we must become the organised will of the people. Pages of Western Spring, we've set out a strategy that we believe nationalists should follow in this country. And I've listed out what I call the six prerequisites. I'm not going to go into those now. And those are focused on fundraising and community building. And I think rather than us go charging out into the streets in street protests, rather than us trying to wage high-profile electoral campaigns, both activities of which just simply make our people targets, waste a lot of money, waste a lot of time, create a lot of heartache, and inevitably bring about failure, what we need to do is to quietly get on with implementing the strategy that I've outlined on the pages of Western Spring, and to adopt another one of the key tactics, which is to act as an organised ethnic group. And I think that we need to be able to, we need to think about what we need to do now in order to be able to make credible representation to the Home Office in the way that immigrant groups do. Because they bypass the democratic process completely and go straight to, as I say, the organ grinder. In order to be taken seriously in that respect, we've got to be able to demonstrate we speak for the majority of our people. And that requires the nationalist movement as a whole to have some kind of convergence, some kind of coalescence into some semblance of a single organisation, so that we can go to the Home Office and claim to speak for all of the awakened white people in this country, who are our ethnic group, effectively. And what I've proposed is that we adopt a nascent term, or a term which invokes a nascent organisation, which I have called and made reference to on a number of occasions in the past, which is the Movement of National Salvation. Not a movement of national salvation, so it's just any one of a load of movements that are competing to be the movement of national salvation, and not the movement for national salvation, which means that it's a movement which wants to try and bring about national salvation. It is the movement of national salvation, the movement that delivers national salvation. And if we will it, it can become a reality. And what I've done recently with the national, with the Western Spring website is that I've added two strap lines to the banner graphic. The first strap line of which says fighting for a white revival. And then underneath where it says Western Spring, I've added partners in the movement of national salvation. And what I'm doing at the moment, I'm partway through a process of approaching other nationalist groups who I believe will comprise the essential component parts of what I think will be a critical mass of the nationalist movement, which will enable us to be able to credibly claim to represent the majority of nationalists. And I'm going to be asking those organisations and those groups, and some of them are just individuals, to take up a position of advocating and declaring their partnership in the movement of national salvation and the fact that they are working for a white revival. And what I hope to do with this organisation is to hold a number of meetings over the course of the next couple of years or so, where we will plan out, because I don't have it devised, I can't speak, I don't know what other people are going to come to the table with, we can't plan it out, but we will devise over a couple of years or so a process of convergence which will then create an embryonic board of governors, which will be the white man's counterpart to the board of deputies, British Jews. And if we can do this, and if we can work as colleagues instead of competitors, we'll be able to harness synergy where the sum of the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, and we'll be able to harness economies of scale by working together, and we will build up trust between nationalist leaders so that where we have a situation at the moment where there is a tremendous amount of mistrust, and that mistrust diminishes the commitment that each one of us can make to our cause, if we can overcome that and through working together on mutual projects, build trust, then we can build an organisation, as I say, that can credibly go to the Home Office and engage them in talks. And initially, I don't expect that it will be the Home Secretary that will come and answer us. It will be some low-level flunky that will be asked to reply to the communications that we have. And there's a process that I've got mapped out in which we will slowly work our way through the flunkies and up through the hierarchy until we're talking to people with a lot more political clout. In order for us to have the same kind of political clout that the Jewish community, for example, has in this country, we would need to have massive amounts of money. And we don't have massive amounts of money. But in numerical terms, the total Jewish population of Britain today is only about 250,000 people. It's about 275,000, I think. And so, theoretically, if we could muster the support beyond the existing active nationalist movement at the moment, so that we could demonstrate a number of people that would be in the same ballpark, and so I'm thinking of perhaps 100,000 people or so, if we could muster 100,000 people over the next couple of years who would all like to participate in this and who would all like to support this initiative. And I've spoken before about fundraising and the necessity for fundraising. If those 100,000 people were prepared to contribute £30 a month, that would produce £30 million a year for that board of governors to spend in promoting our interests directly to the government. And the way in which the representative bodies of other ethnic organisations, the way in which they gain influence over our MPs and politicians nowadays, is that they organise beanos and junkets where they take these people to exotic places for a conference in the Caribbean or something like that, somewhere nice and hot, and this kind of place that people would like to go for a holiday, and they just organise these holidays, and they take these people, all expenses paid, and they wine and dine them. And over a period of time, the corrupt politicians that we have kind of get used to being treated in this way, and they like it, and after a period of time we gain leverage over them in that they won't want that to stop because they will become part of their habitual lifestyle, and so we will then be able to go to them and ask them for things with a reasonable expectation that they will do them. And this is what we need to do, because this is what the ethnic minorities are doing, and this is why ethnic minorities are so much more influential where the government is concerned than the indigenous white people of Britain, sadly. And when I'm talking about us going to the government, obviously there will be a need to have some exploratory talks where we'll have to tread quite carefully, but my expectation is that we won't be watering down the message. And nor am I suggesting that going to the government and lobbying them in this way would be the only thing we need to do, because obviously whilst a small group of the Board of Governors who will be chosen for their silver-tongued qualities will be going and talking to the Home Office, the rest of our organisation will continue to build and will continue to implement the strategy that I've outlined already surrounding the six prerequisites. Majority of our task, though, needs to be done quietly and unobtrusively, and it's already been identified. Our last speaker mentioned that we need to do things unobtrusively, and I think anybody who has any experience and anybody who's thinks deeply into the situation that we're in realises that it is that there is a need for us to employ a certain amount of stealth in terms of bringing about our plans, and it all fits together. We shouldn't waste our time with noisy, short-lived and ultimately unsuccessful election campaigns, nor should we waste our time with short-lived, ultimately unsuccessful demonstrations. And we shouldn't do that because it makes it easy for our enemies to demonise us and present us as thugs and hooligans and terrorists. Lobbying the government directly will be a public relations exercise, and it will also have the advantage of keeping the government off our backs while the rest of our organisation continues to build. And it will keep the government off our backs because it's very difficult, and it will be very difficult for the government to paint us as extremists while they're having regular conversations with us about what we think we need and what we want them to do for us. If we are skulking away in the shadows and we don't let people see who we are and we try and hide from them, then it's very easy for them to paint us as sinister characters and extremists and to demonise us in the eyes of the public. Whereas if they're having regular meetings with us, that is very, very much more difficult for them to do that. As I say, this process of convergence will draw together our strongest elements. There will, and we will begin to look at ourselves as colleagues rather than competitors. We'll enjoy synergy, we'll enjoy economies of scale, and we can then become the organised will of our people. And then we will have a well-oiled and efficient machine, and we've got every reason to believe that this will grow and the movement of salvation, movement of national salvation, will come into being, and that it will bring about the salvation of our people. Thank you. Questions, anybody?
Yeah. I'm going to...
Have you thought about getting in contact with white billionaires from other countries since the fate across the whole world?
I have thought about it, haven't managed to do that yet. But if you've got connections, then I'm quite happy to hear about it.
Have you got any suggestions or ideas or tips that you can raise?
I would say that one element of fundraising should be that it creates a social life for the group within which you are operating. And so what I would say is that you organise meals out or dinners. You know, if somebody, if you've got a member of your group who is a particularly good chef, then and they've got quite a large house, or if they're a good chef and if somebody else in your group has got a large house where you could entertain a sizable number of people, then have some dinner parties where people are encouraged to come and contribute money. I've always found that the most successful way of raising money is just to get people to commit to making a regular monthly contribution. You know, every month, people who are on an average income pay something like £250 a month to the government for the government to show preference to ethnic minority groups and to run this country into the ground. It's not too much to ask people to spend about 10% more than that helping us to build an organisation that will one day have the money to save our people.
I just want to mention that many of these ethnic groups, for example, the Jews, the Mohammedans, the Hindus, have a natural meeting place, so they are called churches, so they're religious organisations. Will they naturally come together and can be brought together to form these ethnic organisations which represent themselves in government? But what do we have among the ethnic white people? We have churches, but all the churches would be opposed to us, wouldn't they, you see?
Get
the people and sufficient people together to form a credible. Yeah, yeah.
Anybody wants to take any food, I'll take it.
What I would say is, in every local area across Britain, there is a hall like this hall. It would be, they don't usually cost very much to hire. Hire one, have a meeting, talk to people about the idea, get them to decide that they're going to join and start to contribute, and take it from there. That's right. But you could also organise trips out to.
What would be the banner under which it would fly? Would it be Western Spring?
We ever get a little food together?
In the Jewish community, they have the synagogue, for example, either Reformed or Orthodox, or whatever it is. The Hindus would have their own.
The key thing is not to get hung up on the name. Everything that I do, every facet of everything that we do within Western Spring has a different name, and that's done deliberately so that the organisation doesn't look, appears to be a loose association of lots of little different groups effectively. And that's just a tactic, because it means that all those names are dispensable, so that if one name gets banned from going to a particular restaurant, then you can book it under a different name and still turn up and be uninterrupted.
Just quickly, from May, you said that you contacted some other organisations and people in our way of thinking. Have you had generally positive feedback from that?
Yeah, the feedback is generally. Okay. The feedback has generally been positive. Sven has very kindly joined this initiative, and you notice on the Radio Aerial website that he has those two strap lines. And what I expect is that over the course of the next 3 months or so, you'll see other organisations put those strap lines on their banner graphic as well.
Forgive me for interrupting. I just got to say thank you for all for
having me.
Thank you. You know, it's nice to have a platform. You know, my left wing, right wing, whatever. Like, it's just nice to have a platform of any kind, which I've not been able to get anywhere else. Thank you very much. Nice to meet again.
Yeah, all the best to you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Right, I have a question. So you're up against a system, and you're trying to explain this, how the system we have works, where you're saying these minority groups lobby the government. But from my understanding, look at the situation, you're talking specifically about Jewish groups, is when you have groups that lobby the government are in effect created or chosen by the government. So for the recent measures we've been discussing, the moves that have been made in recent years have not been through the British Board of Jewish Deputies that's been around for, 200 years. It's been with the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, which was formed in the year 2015. And the government listened to them because they are a right-wing, neoconservative, agitprop group for both Israeli interests and the interests of the Tory party. The system picks the interest groups to give a sort of illusion of lobbying and democracy, but they decide who is who. Yeah, there's a bit of dealing one way, but I would like if you could maybe elucidate this. In what manner are you thinking that we are going to be able to lobby politicians? Especially as if let's say we do have right-wing organizations that are interconnected, a movement that is interconnected and therefore painted by association, and you have the first time a conservative councillor on day one is seen speaking, even if it's behind closed doors, nothing ever stays secret forever, to some, even if it's a front group, even if it's just a local anti-paedophile campaign, there's an expose and you will see a denouncement, much like you saw Jacob Rees-Mogg denounce the traditional breaking group. Claiming ignorance, that would be one example. Could you explain what your vision is for lobbying politicians other than simply with money?
Can I just add to that? I belong to a campaign for English Parliament.
Mm-hmm.
They have a job lobbying. And do you know they actually hold meetings in Parliament?
Okay.
They have a job lobbying.
What you find is that perhaps I shouldn't have given this impression, the Board of Deputies of British Jews don't actually provide most of the junkets and most of the beanos that the politicians go on to. That sort of thing is provided by the Conservative Friends of Israel and Labour Friends of Israel. And so what you have is, as far as Jews are concerned, is you have an assortment of organisations, each of which appears to be slightly different from the others, and each appears to have slightly different membership and slightly different leadership. But effectively, they all work towards the same kind of end of increasing Jewish influence and of taking their arguments directly to government and bypassing the democratic process. They do it using money and political patronage. What we've also seen in recent times is we've seen the IRA or Sinn Féin do the same thing, and they've had meetings with the Prime Minister and with the Home Secretary actually in Downing Street. And that was done not through financial patronage, but by the dangling the candle that they would eventually agree to a peace process if they were given enough.
And violence. They were primarily the reason they were at the table was because they were conducting a campaign.
That's right. It was the character of them desisting in their violence that was the attraction as far as the government is concerned. As far as we're concerned, we're not going to be introduced to the Home Office by any of the Jewish organisations. We're not going to be introduced to them by any of the Muslim organisations that currently lobby the government in the same way. We're not going to be introduced by the IRA or Sinn Féin or anything like that. We will just need to approach them, and once we get a name, employ the most persistent sales tactics necessary. So if you can imagine the most persistent never say die salesman you've ever imagined in your life, then the people who will initially make contact will have to stick with the people they initially identified like glue and make sure that they are so persistent that they can't be ignored, and so that they eventually get some kind of interaction with that person. And once you've got that small amount of interaction, it's got to be the thin end of the wedge that you just hammer in and slowly drive that thin end of the wedge. If you make contact with a junior Home Office flunky, for example, and as a result of them speaking to you and being even just moderately helpful, if you were, for example, to arrange for a brand new Harley Davidson motorbike to be delivered to their house and for them to be handed the keys the following day, then knowledge of that would spread through the Home Office like wildfire, and the next week the Home Office flunkies would be fighting over themselves to be the ones that speak to you and do you a favour.
We're just saying it's going to be difficult to
Yeah, and that's why we need lots of people to join, lots of people to contribute money on a regular basis.
I know the campaign is part of that lobby.
Can I appoint Tommy Robinson the other day? He was able to get in the House of Lords and
Good
interview
point.
One of the Lords who was sympathetic to stopping the Islamisation of Britain and the way that the British people were being silenced. And he was asking questions in the House of Lords.
and he was courageous enough to speak to Tommy Robinson, do the interview in the House of Lords, and he got stick for that from the other MPs, but he was still...
Lord Pearson.
Yeah, he was still keen enough to do the interview, so it is possible to get an audience with him.
He's a former UK.
Yeah, it is possible, I'm not saying it's not possible,
The difference is that Tommy Robinson does it as a process of self-publicisation. That's a word. He's a self-publicist junkie, and that's why he's done it. And that's why he doesn't go in and introduce an organisation, and he doesn't go in and set up a create a relationship with people that he can continue to build that relationship with in promoting our interest. He goes in, does a wham-bam single interview, which is, sometimes controversial, sometimes not so controversial, and that's what he uses then to publicise what he's doing.
But the government's, whoever is in power, have a history of, as soon as a group like us sort of showed that we might be getting somewhere, showing some sort of progress, you saw it in Nick Griffin, they set about destroying that.
And that's why the people that approach the Home Office have got to be squeaky clean people with no criminal record. And as I said earlier on, they've got to be silver tongued devils that can talk their way into or out of any kind of situation. And as I said, just stick like glue. So when you telephone the Home Office the very first time, the very first person that telephones the Home Office is going to have to ask the person what their name is. Mm. Right? And then they write their name down, and then they ask them, have you got a private telephone line into the Home Office so that I can get back to you if I need to speak to you again, and get their line that goes directly to their desk, or if you can get hold of it, get their mobile phone number, or use any pretext you can in order to get the person to telephone you using their mobile phone, in which case you've then got their mobile phone number recorded on your mobile phone. And then once you've got their mobile phone number, you just keep on and on. Every time you just ring in today and ask to speak to them, and if they're not available today, then you ring tomorrow and ask to speak to them, and if they're not available, you ring the next day and the next day and the next day and the next day and the next day. And it's the dripping tap method, the way in which water wears away stone, and eventually the person will ring you back, especially after the first person does you a serious favour and you present them the brand new Harley Davidson.
Like you say, that costs money and that stuff.
That's right.
The problem is these people are inherently and deeply hostile to us. I'm just wondering whether, even if we've got lots of money behind us, why would they entertain us?
It's because money is power. Money, in our current society, money is power. And if you've got money, you've got the power to attract people. People are attracted by money, people are attracted by power. And if you have money, people will be naturally attracted to you. They will. It's a kind of a subconscious psychological process by which they hope that by associating with you, some of the money will rub off and they'll benefit from it. And if you make it plain to them that if they do associate with you and they do do nice things for you and help you in your efforts, that some of your money will most definitely rub off onto them, then they will... it's a bit like training dogs, where you just give them a little tidbit, isn't it? And you just slowly give them a tidbit every time they do the right thing, and don't give them a tidbit when they don't.
Yeah. Well, how many groups are there at the moment? There's us, who's supposed to be the top dog. Anne-Marie Waters got a new group, isn't she? Yeah.
That's right. There are lots
of... What are you all planning to crawl them groups together, are you?
Not necessarily all of them, but a critical mass of them, yes. And once the critical mass is formed, and once the critical mass starts to get results, all the others will join.
Yeah. I mean, the BNP doesn't seem to be very active these days. It's still the most well-known name amongst right-wing groups.
It is. I haven't had any contact with anybody in the leadership of the BNP for a long time.
I was going to say that the leadership of the British National Party is in doubt at the moment, because the four-year term where Adam Walker's been chairman, he's now up for re-election, and there seems to be little direction within the party itself at this moment in time.
Maybe so, it's still the most well-known name.
Oh, it is, yeah. I mean, we had two MEPs back in 2009, Andrew Bronze and Nick Griffin.
If you go somewhere, go somewhere and you get talking to people about political issues and you say, well, actually, I'm sympathetic to the BNP, they know immediately you're talking about it. If you say you're sympathetic to someone else, who's that or what do they do? You know what I mean? Yeah. So the BNP is not a name you want to destroy.
Just no, like that was 10 years ago. Yeah. There's a whole generation of voters, and I know them, and they don't know who the BNP are.
No.
It's to them, it's like the National Front or the British Union of Fascists.
Will they vote, really? That's the
people.
Thanks, Max.
Thank you. Max.
You are listening to Radio Aryan for an alternative to the anti-white system on RadioAryan.com.